Not too shabby a week so far for Russia's leader of 24 years, sandwiched between a Moldova referendum where the pro-EU camp underwhelmed and a crucial general election in fellow former Soviet state Georgia. Is the BRICS summit. Forget International Criminal Court arrest warrants. Vladimir Putin rolling out the red carpet for some 20 world leaders by the banks of the Volga in the Tatarstan capital of Kazan. Despite those Western sanctions over Ukraine, the sputterings of a slowing Chinese economy, at the BRICS summit, new names lining up to join the BRICS, a club of emerging world giants whose fortunes seemed, critics said, tied to the whims of world commodity prices. If, as billed, it's much more than just a trade talk shop, then what are the BRICS all about in 2024? And if Vladimir Putin's having a good week so far, what about 2 weeks from now? If Donald Trump returns to the White House, we'll ask our panel how the former Soviet world sees that prospect. Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at Vladimir Putin's BRICS summit. Joining us from the Latvian capital, Riga, Una Alexandra Berzina Cherenkova, director of Riga Stardins University's China Studies Center. Welcome to the show.
Good evening.
From Georgia's capital, Tbilisi, France 24 correspondent Régis Jeantet, your latest book in French, Our Man in Washington, about the links between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. How are you?
Good evening. I'm good.
Historian Jacques Rupnik, Emeritus Director of Research at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po Paris. Good to see you.
Good evening.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24Debate. Yeah, the Kremlin's billed it as the largest diplomatic gathering Russia's seen in decades. Emerald Maxwell has more.
Yeah. Welcoming his professed dear friend Xi Jinping to the 16th annual BRICS summit, Vladimir Putin said Moscow and Beijing would work towards creating global security and a just world order. The Chinese leader hailed their country's ties.
The world is undergoing profound changes unseen in a century, and the international situation is becoming chaotic and intertwined. But I firmly believe that the profound friendship between China and Russia from generation to generation will not change.
As this year's host, the Russian leader is eager to show that he isn't that isolated on the world stage. Heads of state from over 20 countries gathering in the city of Kazan were greeted off the plane with traditional Russian cakes. The BRICS grouping of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa has now expanded to include Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, and the United Arab Emirates. Saudi Arabia has also been invited to join the bloc, seen as a counterweight to the West.
Over the past 15 years of its existence, our BRICS association has created a special role for itself, and today many countries want to join.
The summit is the biggest such meeting in Russia since it ordered troops into Ukraine. India has avoided explicit condemnation of Moscow's actions while casting itself as a potential peacemaker. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who has also urged an end to the conflict, praised Moscow as a valued ally and friend in his meeting with Putin. The Russian president was forced to abandon plans to attend last year's summit in South Africa after the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants against him.
All right, before Régis Jeantet, I ask you about pageantry and summitry, tell us a little about Kazan itself, the venue for this summit.
We had no statement from anyone in Russia to explain why it was Kazan who was chosen. But it seems to me quite obvious that Kazan is the capital of Tatarstan, which is a Muslim republic of Russia. And it was a way for the Kremlin to appear like a global south. I hate this expression. We'll come back to that. But at least to look like more a country from the south, let's say. And this is why they organized this BRICS summit in Kazan. It seems to me.
Kazan, a city that's undergone transformation.
Yes. That's also a kind of window of the modern Russia. This is a rich capital, a rich subject of the Russian Federation, because in Tatarstan there is a lot of oil. And it makes this republic very rich. And also, it's a kind of success for Russia, because at the beginning of the 90s, the Tatarstan was thinking about some kind of separatism, at the same time than Chechnya. But finally, they agreed to sign the treaty with Russia and to remain into the Russian Federation.
Which brings us to the summit itself. Una Alexandra Berzina Cherenkova, again, Russia bragging that it's the biggest diplomatic gathering it's hosted there in decades, possibly ever. And of course, that's a reference to the West's attempt to isolate it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. For Russia, it is a photo op. It is a platform that it does not stand alone on its invasion of Ukraine. The Russian media, of course, talks about how leading global media report that isolation of Russia has not been successful. So this is just as much about domestic audiences as it is about outside audiences. And what we see is an attempt by Putin trying to make this about geopolitics and about security. And BRICS obviously is not about security. But Putin said during the when Russia was taking over as the chair of BRICS that naturally we will place special emphasis on enhancing the foreign policy coordination of the participating countries. Good luck with that. Jointly seeking effective responses to the challenges and threats of international and regional security and stability. This is a desperate attempt to make it look like all the countries that are attending the summit are somehow supportive of his policy, of his invasion of Ukraine. But that, I would like to argue that it's not the case. Yes, BRICS expresses a resentment vis-a-vis the West for some countries, but many have a very nice working relationship with Western counterparts. And of course, it's not an exclusive kind of either or, as attested by Turkey here. And secondly, every member sees something different in BRICS. BRICS is like a mirror, in fact. And so states want to have this platform to talk. Many express an interest in cooperation with what China has to offer. But to say that these are countries that are showing support for Russia's invasion of a sovereign neighbor is a stretch. But of course, Russia will try to sell it that way, already is doing it. And this is where we have to note that Guterres accepting the invitation does not.
And so Vladimir Putin, his dream, if you will, is Una Alexandra to have a currency that enables members to bypass the U.S. dollar, which is weaponized to impose sanctions. How's it going?
Well, I'm not an economist, but I have to say Putin is, of course, a storyteller here, and he's relying on China's clout to make it a reality. At the same time, many of the countries do not necessarily sign up to that agenda. But even China is kind of trying to distance itself from a friends without limits narrative. We have Global Times quoting Xi Jinping's meeting with Putin, that he has said that China and Russia have found the right way for neighboring major countries to get along, which features non-alliance, non-confrontation, and not targeting any third party. So I think that this is a story of Russia trying to show that it has solutions to the economic challenges brought about by the sanctions. And by the way, if I quickly made the visuals point towards this too, we see during the arrival of the world leaders, this guard of honor, these tall men, kind of to challenge the Western perception that somehow Russia is losing out in the field in Ukraine, and to counter the visuals that we see of depraved of food Russian soldiers who have to buy their own munition and so on. So this is a story that Putin is telling, and let's make sure we don't help him tell it.
All right, so let's just recap here, Jacques Rupnik. There is no consensus on any kind of security agreement. There is no consensus even on a common currency. There's no consensus when it comes to Ukraine. What is the BRICS about in 2024?
The BRICS is growing alliance. Remember, there were seven at the beginning. Now you have about 30 candidates. So obviously, they have something going for them. What is it? Is essentially, I think the common denominator is an anti-Western sentiment. The idea that the West, international relations have been dominated by West for too long. And number of people, particularly if you take the situation 2 years ago, Russia had invaded Ukraine, overwhelming condemnation. I mean, just two or three states maybe, supported that. And you look at the situation now, the very fact that they can hold this summit in Russia is, I think, for Putin, can be considered as an achievement. And the idea is what unites them is an anti-Western posture. As has been said, they disagree on many other things. And the proposal about the currency, that we're going to trade in rubles, in rupees, etc., in order to bypass the dollar, this is nonsense.
This is a club that includes the likes of Brazil and India. Are they really anti-Western?
Well, they have differences with the West, and they India certainly plays a balancing act between the West and Russia. It has a rather tense relationship, to put it mildly, with China, but it certainly doesn't mind getting cheap energy from Russia. You Europeans don't want it, we buy it. Thank you. So it's a pragmatic move, I think, on the part of India. But I think that if one has to find an explanation what has happened between a year or two ago and today, you couldn't have had this summit in Russia. The fact that you have it there, I think something has happened, and that is a connection or interference between the two wars. There's a war in Ukraine and there's a war in the Middle East. And on the war in Ukraine, okay, overwhelming condemnation. But now that there is a war in Gaza in the Middle East, sparked by Hamas's pogrom in Israel, over the time, we have seen number of voices saying the West really doesn't care too much about Palestinian lives. It cares about Ukrainian lives and not Palestinian. I'm not saying this is a correct interpretation, but so-called Global South, it has been said it's a formula.
So there's a Middle East factor.
I don't like
that
it. Suddenly the West doesn't do enough to stop the war there, and it gives support to Ukraine in a war. While it is ignoring, let's say, its role in the Middle East. This is partial interpretation of what has happened, why so many countries would join such an anti-Western alliance.
Jacques Rupnik, you mentioned there India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who is an ally of Israel, but at the same time has a public opinion that feels that conflict that you describe over the West's priorities. Narendra Modi, who last summer visited Ukraine, that was seen as a show of support. Here's what he had to say when he had his sit-down with Vladimir Putin earlier.
Excellency, we've been in constant touch over the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. As I said earlier too, we believe that disputes should only be resolved peacefully. We totally support efforts to quickly restore peace and stability. All our efforts put humanity first. India is ready to offer all possible support in the time to come.
Régis Jeantet, when you're listening there, are you listening to the Indian leader who speaks sometimes plain truths when it comes to Ukraine to Vladimir Putin, or, as Jacques Rupnik pointed out, the man who buys discounted oil?
I think it's both. I think this morning in the Bloomberg published an article with some advisors of Mr. Modi or some high-level diplomats from India, saying that they don't want to let Putin transform the BRICS as an anti-Russia, anti-US organization. So it says a lot about what BRICS is. Indeed, there are a lot of countries who come there and think that the BRICS should be anti-West. For others, I think it's more about distancing from the West, getting more flexibility, more possibility to defend their own interests. And even for China, it's true. This morning, there was also an article in the South China Morning Post. So it's, we know that the newspaper very much reflecting the position of the Chinese leadership. And they were distancing from the BRICS, also saying that, for example, the de-dollarization is not working, that the BRICS is not an effective organization. So I think Jacques Rupnik has a point. Indeed, the fact that it is organized in Russia is really meaningful. In the meantime, we see all the countries taking what is good for them. I will take an example that I know very well, which is Kazakhstan, one of the countries that I'm working on. And Kazakhstan, for example, decided to not be part of BRICS. They refused to become a member because they want also to keep a good relation with the West, and they don't want to be too much associated with the BRICS, which look like more and more dominated by Russia and China and anti-US, especially, and anti-West.
Just a final word on this whole theme about the pushback against the West. We saw earlier the images of the Palestinian president arriving. He had that honor guard that Un Alexandra was describing, like everyone else, when Mahmoud Abbas, when he landed. Jacques Rupnik, we're also expecting the UN Secretary General to attend. If this BRICS is turning into some kind of emanation of the non-aligned movement or what was then called the G77, that's normal, right?
Well, up to a point, because there is one absentee in this gathering, and that is the Saudi King bin Salman. And there is one surprising attendee, and that is the Secretary General of the United Nations. What is the Secretary General of the United Nations doing at a gathering organized by Vladimir Putin in Russia? Secretary General is supposed to uphold the Charter of the United Nations. The Charter has been violated by Russia's aggression in Ukraine. There he goes to Russia to visit Putin, to discuss with Putin. I understand he will meet him on Thursday. I think we need a lot of explaining from him about what he's doing at this gathering. This is not a UN gathering. This is a particular group which has a very anti-Western agenda. We'll have to see what he has to say, but his presence there is rather astonishing.
Okay, Una Alexandra Brzina, you hear Jacques Rupnik skeptical about Antonio Guterres' decision to travel to Kazan. I mean, his job, his remit is diplomacy. So isn't that a good thing that he's going?
Certainly, anything he says, even if he tells Putin to immediately stop the invasion of Ukraine, which we know is not in Guterres' speaking notes, doesn't matter, because as long as he's giving the FaceTime, as long as he's giving, in his position, the time of day for this platform in Russia, in Kazan, meeting with a wanted criminal, somebody who couldn't show up at the previous BRICS summit in Johannesburg, embarrassingly, because of the warrant. So if you have the SecGen of the UN showing up there, this is just bad optics. And I think the Ukrainian ambassador made a very strong point of that at the UN earlier today, or was it yesterday? Days fly, sorry.
Yeah, so you have the visit of the UN Secretary General, and as you can see, that's going to be a point of contention. Just to point out, while the BRICS summit is taking place, one continent, one ocean away from Kazan is Washington, D.C. And there they're opening the annual meetings of the IMF in World Bank, institutions that are born of that post-World War II order that determined the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. And now, imagine today you're a developing, you're from the developing world, you're a leader of a country, and you're shopping for some fresh financing. This is the message you're getting out of Washington this week. Inflation slowing, but investment money's tight.
This is happening at the time when our forecasts point to an unforgiving combination of low growth and high debt, a difficult future. Let's take a closer look. Medium-term growth is forecast to be lackluster, not sharply lower than pre-pandemic, but far from good enough. Not enough to eradicate world poverty, nor to create the number of jobs we require, nor to generate the tax revenues that governments need to service heavy debt loads, while attending to vast investment needs, including for the green transition.
So, Jacques Rupnik, you're the leader of a developing country. You hear that speech out of Washington, you'd be more tempted to listen to what they have to say at the BRICS summit?
I'm not sure. I mean, the BRICS represent about a third of the global GDP. So they've become an important economic actor. China, India, etc. are. But the United States and Europe remain a major a driving force in the economy. And I can see the criticism towards the United States, and President Biden has sometimes been criticized for, I mean, his economic policy has been remarkably successful. I mean, he has brought down inflation belatedly, but the growth in America, the unemployment is at its lowest in America. And so,
but again, we're talking about those G77 nations, and we're talking about where you're going to go if you want fresh money right now. Is it more towards Washington or more towards the folks in Kazan?
Well, some of the folks in Kazan are ready to give you money, but they buy and they put very stringent conditions. You know, the assumption is, oh, the West, they are so-called imperialists. They have these ambitions to control. Look at what the Chinese are doing in Africa, in Latin America. They're buying and they're controlling. And I think, the so-called third world has not yet fully discovered what the BRICS countries' potential is. But what I would say is the fact that the American economy is in good shape now is actually a good news for the rest of the economy. Of course, the Europeans, for instance, are dissatisfied with the fact that some of the European money, the Inflation Reduction Act, in the United States, has meant that some European funds have been transferred to America. So Europeans are concerned about that. They say they think it's unfair competition. Okay, this may be true. But on the whole, you need a strong American economy if you want to solve some of the global problems, including those mentioned by the IMF.
All right. And so you have Régis Jeanté there mentioning how Kazakhstan's leader is wary of signing up to the club. Former Soviet states in the news this week. Moldova's incumbent president, well, she's been licking her wounds after Sunday. Maya Sandu forced into a runoff, winning only 42% in the first round of the presidential election, while the same day a pro-EU referendum in Moldova that seemed like a slam dunk turned into a squeaker, with the yes vote winning by 50.39% of the vote. Sandu cried foul over alleged vote-buying by the pro-Moscow camp. The BBC went to the breakaway region of Transnistria that's home to Russian soldiers and spoke with voters who openly asked about their payout. You came from Transnistria. You asked for a payout. I'm still waiting for my money. Régis Jeanté, your thoughts about what we saw in Moldova last weekend?
I think the result is not a surprise. I'm going to Moldova since 20 years. I'm working on that country, which is very interesting to understand what's going on in the post-Soviet area. And there were years where 60% of the population were pro-European, while 40% were pro-Russia. And you would come 2 years later, it would be exactly the opposite, 60% pro-Russian, let's say, and 40% pro-European. So this country is, even at its origin, it's a kind of a geopolitical project to be a kind of buffer zone between Soviet Union and Russia and Europe. So the result is not a surprise at all. And it reflects somehow what happened. So, of course, the question of the votes which were bought by Russia through some influence, through some oligarchs, is something real. But I feel also what Maya Sandu said was partly a way also to hide that the defeat was her defeat. And partly because also the pro-Western camp in Moldova, and I can see that even in Georgia and other countries, have the tendency to ignore and to have some disdain even towards the pro-Russian people and not to address their problem, not to go to visit them and try to conquer their votes. So I think this is also explaining a lot what happened this weekend in Moldova. Then there is a difficult situation, the price hike of the gas, which really increased a lot after the large-scale invasion of Ukraine. The price of the gas in Moldova was sometimes more than a half of the salary of the people. So it was unbearable. Europe helped a lot, but still the situation was really heavy for most of the Moldovan population.
Una Alexandra Brzezina-Cherenkova, do we sometimes have hubris here inside of the European Union? We think everybody wants to join the EU.
Well, I come from the region, the Baltics, which is a success story. After joining in 2004, things have really picked up. So in a sense, I think often we are also the voice when it comes to the enlargement countries, talking about the positive sides of this. But of course, at the same time, it's not about hubris, but it's also about the fact that there are issues within the EU that we, within an open information environment, of course, very freely discuss, you know, cost of living crisis, rise in anti-migration populist politics, all the gender politics issues. So in that sense, that also perhaps sometimes has an off-putting image. But I'm still a strong advocate for open information and for strong media. When it comes, and just a quick comment on the Russian and the pro-Russian population, and just the Latvian example, perhaps economy is a good way, you know, to get these votes, but it's not enough. We have been perhaps underestimating the role of identities when it comes to these votes. And we see in Latvia roughly one-third of Russian speakers being very pro-European, pro-Western, anti-Russian invasion in Ukraine, one-third being in the middle, and one-third being strictly stringent pro-Putin. So in a sense, perhaps just going to see the voters is not enough.
Yeah, Jacques Hubnik, you don't have to go as far as Moldova. In neighboring Germany, there's more than 1 million Russian speakers, and some of them feel like they're looked down upon.
Mm. Well, perhaps they are. They chose to come to Germany, many of them became Russian German citizens, and maybe they feel ill at ease. The big problem in Germany is more the eastern part of Germany, and that's not a question of the Russians, it's more the...
But do you agree with Una Alexandra that there is an identity issue here?
There is an identity, and Moldova is an in-between country, you know. Most of what is Moldova today used to be part of Romania before the war. It was called Bessarabia. And in fact, a lot of the Romanians consider this land as being part of the so-called Greater Romania. The Romanian nationalists would say so. And then you have the Transnistria, the Russian-speaking place controlled by the Russian. They even had a referendum 30 years ago, saying they want to be attached to Russia. But Russians didn't even bother to follow up on this offer. So Russians prefer to have an enclave they can use if need be. I think what it shows is that the country is split, it's divided. And it's divided partly because of the war in Ukraine has brought this into the open. Because you have basically a pro-European candidate. It doesn't mean the others don't want Europe at all. But partly the propaganda has been clever at suggesting that to vote for Europe, vote for the West, means you are siding with Ukraine and you are going to drag the country into this war. I'm not saying this is a correct reading, but this is something that has been used by the Russians, by the Russian propaganda. So, yes, we have a divided country, and I think the difficult task for the president, she I think, understands the situation, is you, if you have a split country, 50.3 victory, I mean, for the referendum, you must tread very carefully. And I think that her job would be healing, trying to bridge the gaps between a divided society. But she has a second round in a presidential election to face.
Yeah.
So first she has to get over that hurdle, win the presidency, and then she has a task of not playing the polarization. Yeah. She can still be the pro-European candidate and has stretch to the other, to the rest of the society. Important thing to mention, a quarter of Moldova's population lives abroad. Where? In the European Union. And they voted in the election. And they voted massively for the EU. So you have a vote by the expatriates. 75% of the expatriates voted for the EU. And it actually helped to get that victory,
get that
this
over the,
European
over
victory. So, yes, Moldovans are already partly in the EU. They're working here and they're sending their money back to help their families.
Okay, that was last Sunday. Let's talk about next Saturday. In Georgia, the vote of, in a general election just a few days away. There's the pro-EU camp. It's on edge, but with the ruling Georgia Dream Party pulling out all the stops. Still, opposition supporters, like at this rally in Tbilisi on Sunday, sounding upbeat notes.
Once we win on 26th of October, it's going to be a win not only for Georgia, but it's going to be a win for Armenia, for South Caucasus, for Black Sea security, for even Central Asian countries who have a road connecting towards Europe. So it's a geopolitical change, and it's going to happen because we will do it.
We will do it, says that opposition supporter, Georgia's kingmakers, a billionaire former prime minister who made his fortune in Russia in the 1990s, Bidzina Ivanishvili, who in an interview with the Reuters news agency denies being either pro or anti-Kremlin.
We will not be able to change Russia. It would be better for us to change ourselves. It would be better for us to work more on ourselves. We have to try to establish relations with Russia that exist the way it is. The most important thing for us is not to add our own mistakes to any mistakes that Russia may already be making in order not to aggravate our relationship.
Régis Chanté, that call for a bit of therapy on the part of Georgians to work on themselves. How's that going down?
Yeah, I mean, what is clear now is that this oligarch is totally tied by Russia, and this is why he implemented a pro-Russian policy since long, but mostly since 3 years. Obviously, he's even sometimes going against probably his will and against the will of most of the Georgians indeed. And this is why the election on Saturday is extremely important and is extremely risky as well, because it's not excluded that part of the population will refuse the results, because we see a lot of manipulation of the votes, a lot of people which are under pressure and so on. And everybody understands in Georgia that this election is a kind of last chance to remain on the Western side, while the government is trying to bring again Georgia on the Russian side.
And if I may, Régis, you heard what Jacques Rupnik had to say about some in Moldova worried that being pro-EU means being dragged into open or direct conflict with Russia. You're sitting in a country that had a war with Russia in 2008. Are there many who will vote for the Georgia Dream Party because of that reasoning? They don't want conflict with Russia, and they can buy this way.
They will also, because, and this is absolutely true, what Jack Rupnik said, and we can apply it to Georgia. The difference is that in Moldova, you would have 50% in the opinion polls showing that the population is somehow pro-Russian or wants to be more oriented towards Russia, which is almost not existing in Georgia. You would have some small segment of the population which would be cautious with Russia, saying we don't want Europe or NATO because it's risky, but they are not pro-Russian. And so most of the propaganda or the communication of the government today is to say that the West wants to open a second front, this is how they speak, in the Caucasus after Ukraine. And voting for the pro-Western parties is voting for the war. This is what they call the global war party.
Una Alexandra Berzina-Cherenkova, the European Union in the last months opening up the candidacy process for Georgia. The EU shares a border with Moldova, does not share a border with Georgia. Your thoughts on how the EU is handling things. Is the EU got its messaging right when it comes to both countries?
Well, the EU certainly has a long history of embarrassing invitations that never really take place. Let's go back to Turkey again, of course. And so the EU is treading very carefully. But what the EU cannot control is what is happening domestically in those countries. And Georgia is a prime example of that. And I just want to go back to these examples of issue pairing that you mentioned, that, you know, voting for Europe means basically bringing Russia's war onto your own soil. This kind of these are famous and widely used information manipulation tactics. So issue pairing and slippery slope arguments that Russia is known for. And even though we are already in the EU, we still are facing these. Don't talk about, when it comes to Russian disinformation, don't talk about Ukraine that much. You will bring peril on yourself. So I think what the EU can control is perhaps unity, or try to control is more unity amongst its member states to extend the hand. But what the EU cannot control is the domestic situation in those countries and, of course, blatant Russian meddling.
Jacques Rupnik?
Absolutely. The EU is attractive because, I mean, you compare the situation, let's say, Poland and Ukraine. Anybody can compare. In 1989, they had the same GDP per capita. 30 years after, Poland has more than three times the GDP of Ukraine per capita. So if you are in one of those countries, in Moldova, in the Caucasus, you don't need to be a great strategic thinker to think your future is more democratic and more prosperous with the EU. This is, of course, easier said than done, because for a long time, the EU was reluctant to open to these countries. They had a neighborhood policy which didn't include enlargement to the EU. It's only the war in Ukraine that has changed this perspective, and the EU suddenly said, yes, Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia have become candidates. So that is a change, really. It's a major change, and it has brought, perhaps, into the open some of the tensions. So it has a reform agenda to move closer to the EU. And on the other hand, you have a strong resistance of forces that stand to lose or that are victim of the kind of argument we've heard from the Georgian leader who said, Russia will not change, so we better change in that direction. We have to adapt to the fact that Russia will remain Russia and therefore will remain threatening. So that's a choice I offered. Either you have to change to adapt to Russia, or you should change in the other direction and move closer to Europe. That's the politics of that region.
Okay, so more elections ahead in Moldova, elections ahead on Saturday in Georgia. And while Vladimir Putin's hosting that BRICS summit over in the United States, it's exactly 2 weeks before Election Day, the home stretch of a presidential election campaign. There you see Donald Trump serving French fries at McDonald's in Pennsylvania on Sunday. Régis Jeantet, we devoted an entire show that you took part in after the publication of your book to the links between Trump and Vladimir Putin. when you look at the events on the U.S. campaign trail in the last couple of weeks, your thought of on the optics of Trump on the campaign trail over in the U.S. and the BRICS summit taking place in Kazan?
Yeah, everybody seems to resonate to each other. And indeed, all these weeks, this fall and this beginning of winter would be extremely important for the future of the world. Indeed, I'm convinced after writing this book and working quite deeply on the relations between Mr. Trump and Russia, that indeed one of the first things that Mr. Trump will do is really to stop to provide armament to Ukraine, and it will change a lot because Ukraine is not only about Ukraine. This conflict is about who will dominate the world, what will be the place of the West, of the democracies, and this is exactly what is at stake. So all these events are resonating with each other. And as Jacques Lepnik said, still the Europe and the West is attractive. While Russia is not attractive, Russia has to do the war to manage to keep its influence in the world. And the war is a failure, as it is a failure for every country in the world. But Russia is only the war. It started in Georgia back in 2008, and now it continues in Ukraine.
We'll continue, of course, to monitor all of it. Régis Jeantet, I want to thank you so much for joining us from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. I want to thank Una Alexandra Brzina, Cherenkova, and the Latvian capital, Riga. Jacques Rupnik, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.